And then he came and did a stint on the largest universities of Canada. So he was in CETA as a postdoc, McGill as a CETA National Fellow, and then UBC. Later on, went to Purdue for his, you know, assistant professor. And he's going to be talking with Double Pulsar and probably just GI with him.
Yes. So Double Pulsar, Aurora Borealis, and basic theories of gravity, very different things, but as I will argue, they will have something in common. So if you do a search on Google, the first thing about the Double Pulsar canister is you can get a very good deal on these two Pulsar watches. And actually, I really like this thing because, as we will see, the idea of two watches, or actually two clocks, is very much relevant to the real Double Pulsar. So, we'll be talking about death remnants of stars, and there are three ways for a star to die. Not very massive stars end up as white dwarfs, medium as neutron stars, and very massive as black holes. And we'll be discussing the end products of the medium-range stars, which is neutron stars. So, neutron stars are born during supernova explosion, when the nuclear fuel is exhausted in the core. Everything in the core is optically thick to neutrinos, and these neutrinos induce turbulence. And the turbulence plus convection and rotation is actually very good for dynamo, meaning for amplification of magnetic field. And as we will see, neutron stars have very large magnetic fields, and up to 15 Gauss, and that's probably how these fields are amplified during this turbulent motion. Also, this turbulence gives a kick and a tumble to a newborn neutron star, and with our Double Pulsar, we'll be able to determine the parameters of those kicks and tumbles. So neutron stars, I'm sure all of you know, just quickly, 10 kilometers, a few of the order of a solar mass, period from milliseconds to 100 seconds, radio pulses only a few seconds, magnetic fields up to 10 to 15 Gauss, which is larger than the quantum magnetic field, probably the highest static magnetic fields in the universe. Just a reminder, at Earth, the fields are limited to about 100 Tesla, and the reason is the strength of materials. The Lorentz stress induces such a Lorentz force induces a large stress, and everything just cracks and breaks down. And of course, there is a lot of discussion whether you can have some interesting nuclear physics in the core, like strange stars, and the phase diagram at the low energies is very interesting and exciting. So there might be some implications. Studying neutron star might have some implications for the nuclear matter. So pulses were discovered in 67 by Jocelyn Bell, and notoriously she didn't get a Nobel Prize for that, and you can guess the reason. So now pulses are a very active area of research. Recently launched Fermi satellite is discovering many gamma ray pulsars, dozens in blind searches. And apparently it was seen by US military years before, but after they discovered that it's not related to it, Russians, they discarded the information. And now we see pulses from radio through optical to X-ray to the very highest energy gamma rays, up to 100 GeV gamma rays. So, magnetospheres of isolated pulsars, and here the important point will be that it's isolated, and our Double Pulsar is not isolated, but just a reminder. So, we have a neutron star, we have dipolar field lines, and rotation, and we have a magnetic moment which is not aligned with the rotation axis. And the rotation induces induced electric fields that pull up charges. And then on the field lines that are closed inside the light cylinder, you form a static charge distribution, while on the field lines that go through the light cylinder, the charges can flow out freely. And radio emission is thought to be generated somewhere on the open field lines, perhaps close to the magnetic moment, directional magnetic moment.
Can you remind people what light cylinder is?
Light cylinder is the distance where a solid body rotation would have proceeded with the speed of light. Meaning you can have field lines rotating solidly if they don't extend out of the light cylinder, and they have to open up if field line, magnetic field lines cross the light cylinder. Okay? So the structure is like though this cartoon was interesting, the structure is actually very complicated because it's a highly non-linear electromagnetic system. And again, the idea is that magnetic fields generate electric fields pull up charges, so the magnetosphere is loaded with charge density and currents that in turn modify the dipolar field lines, and the structure becomes very complicated. And only recently, even the simplest analytical calculations were able to produce magnetospheres only just a few years ago. And this is a simulation of oblique rotator, which was also done only a few years ago. So it's a very difficult problem. Very difficult non-linear electromagnetic problem. So, the double pulsar. This was considered the sixth most important scientific discovery of 2004. It was discovered by Parkes in multi-beam receiver survey in Australia. So it consists of two pulsars. One is will be called A. It's 22 milliseconds, so it's very fast. It's period. That is B, 2.7 seconds. And the A is old and fast. B is slow and young. The orbit, the system is really exceptional. It's in a very tight orbit, just 2.4 hours. Pulses are separated by 3 light seconds. It's fairly close by, only 1 kiloparsec away. And quite interestingly, the system is observed almost edge on. The line of sight makes something like half a degree with the orbital plane. And the system is truly exceptional. It leads to a lot of interesting things. It allows precise measurement of masses, testing GR where we're down to hundreds of a percent.
So, question. Why is the one that goes faster older?
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah. It might be possible to measure moment of inertia, and also it allows the direct probe of pulse in the sphere and relativistic plasma physics. So here is a discovery of A. So here is period versus time. Period folded with many like 10 or 20 rotation periods. And this is the brightness, and as you can see, the pulsar A is double peaked. But these bright curves, bright lines are curved, and that's because it tells immediately that it's in a binary orbit. So the pulses arrive a little bit earlier or a little bit later, depending on the phase. And then the pulsar B was discovered. So here is formation and LIGO predictions. You need to start with two very a system of two very massive binary stars, larger than say 10 solar masses. Then the more massive explodes first and leaves pulsar A. Then this pulsar A slows down by it loses energy, slows down, and also somehow its magnetic field becomes smaller. And that we don't quite understand how the magnetic field becomes smaller, but it's a fact. Then the second star starts evolving, and as the second star evolves, it transfers mass, starts transferring mass onto the pulsar A. And by transferring mass, it spins it up. It spins it up to millisecond frequencies. And also, since magnetic field somehow decayed, magnetic field of pulse A somehow becomes small during this process of transfer, pulse A doesn't slow down anymore. Typically, you know, they stay with the given frequency. It slows down, but very little. Then you can have the second supernova explosion, and if the system is not disrupted, you can be left out with two neutron stars. And if you're lucky enough, you can see both of them as pulsars. Now, the details of this formation is not very clear. Population synthesis. The good thing about, some people think it's a good thing, that this one system increases the estimates of neutron star coalescence by an order of magnitude. But of course, if one point dominates your statistics, you don't know if that point comes from the tail of the distribution or from the middle of the distribution. But anyway, it's very good for LIGO. It cranked up all the estimates for them. So, and here back to the deal that you can get on Google on two pulsar watches. This is an excellent test ground of general relativity, meaning you have two clocks by rotation, because rotation is fairly stable. And by observing the pulsars, we have two clocks, two watches, if you wish, that are moving in curved space, and then we can study the details of the curved space. So here is an example of the so-called Shapiro delay. When pulsar A is behind pulsar B, and that's the line of the observer, you can think of it as the light has to travel a little bit longer in this kind of embedding diagram. It's not correct, exactly correct, but it's kind of qualitative, the correct description. So that means the pulsar should arrive a little bit later when A is behind B, and that's indeed when you see this. And then you can clearly see this in 5 minutes of integration. These are the superior conjunctions, and you can see this clearly in these peaks. And if you average over a few years, you get a very nice fit to the Shapiro delay. So here is, the way the testing of GR is done is that by measuring Keplerian parameters, you can predict within any given model of gravity what should be the post-Keplerian parameters. And general relativity, everything is determined by masses. By masses and measured Keplerian parameters. So one of the useful ways of plots of testing general relativity is to plot different measurements of various post-Keplerian parameters on the mass-mass diagram. Mass of B, mass of A. And here are 5 different post-Keplerian parameters plotted. And you can see that the precision is so that we need to blow up this picture by 1,000 and see that indeed there is one unique set of masses that, and all the measured post-Keplerian parameters agree with that unique set of masses. That gives us precision of a mass determination of the order of 1/10,000th of a solar mass. And that was just, by the way, like 3 years ago. Orbit shrinks by 7 millimeters a day due to the gravitational radiation. The Shapiro parameter fits to within, as I say, of the order of 10,000, the precision. And this is a different non-radiative test of general relativity. It might be possible to measure moment of inertia due to the addition of the precession of the periastron. And from the gravitational precession, you expect about 10 to the minus 4 degrees per year. And that should be extracted from the bulk precession, which is about 16 degrees per year. And just compare it with Mercury, where it's 42 arc seconds per century. Here it's 16 degrees per year, a huge effect. So we needed to extract it of the order of 10 to the minus 5. And as we see, we already did the precision of 10 to the minus 4. So it will be possible within a few years. And that'll be, so this depends on the moment of inertia. We know the frequency, so then the rotation of space time depends on the moment of inertia. And that'll be we can do some inferences about the equation of state of nuclear matter and super dense matter. And
so matching this, it would take a few years to go deep on this higher parameter. Does that require just more statistics or more data, or does
yes.
it require an error?
Yes, more statistics.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it, the precision on this grows sort of linearly this time because of longer base. And we will have another test of general relativity, which I will discuss in this talk.
Can you tell us what these other ones are? There are like gamma and the capital R?
These are omega dot, that's the first correction, the first Jia correction. P dot, that's the gravitational wave. S is the Shapiro delay. Gamma is the another Shapiro parameter. And R is, I don't remember.
What is the capital R, the diagonal red line?
That's the ratio, mass ratio. Because here we have two clocks, and by observing the two, timing both pulses, we can determine their mass ratio independently. We can determine their semi-major axis independently.
And what's the yellow versus the white?
Yellow.
You got a yellow area and there's a white
area. Oh, this area is excluded. No, the white is allowed. Yellow is excluded. I don't remember.
White's allowed and yellow.
Yeah. Yellow is excluded. White is allowed. So I didn't consider it this white. Yeah. So, the post-Keplerian parameter agree with GR down to a few hundreds of a percent. So again, post-Keplerian radar function of masses and Keplerian parameters. We know the spins that are sufficiently small. The spin of A, first of all, is sufficiently small. But the actual dependence can be different in different theories.
This is a question. Why do you call it post-Keplerian and not post-Newtonian?
I think it is in the synonym.
Yeah, same
thing?
Okay.
I think there's, yeah. Yeah, it's either PPN or PK. I think they're used interchangeably.
I never heard of that.
And there will be a fifth post-Keplerian or post-Newtonian test in addition to that. And as you can see, so the S, the Shapiro delay, we are down to the fourth digit.
I think the distinction is that if you have a Keplerian orbit, it's just observational things and things like that you wouldn't process, for instance, in this. So having a secular drift in Keplerian parameters defines post-Keplerian parameters.
Yes.
But that doesn't have a theoretical interpretation.
So that's right. It's pure phenomenological. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
But post-Newtonian then would be like saying, or would be saying that you're now using the theory of gravity to predict what the Hubble-Lissing is related to masses or something.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Correct. So post-Keplerian, they're trying to do this phenomenologically without appealing to any theory of gravity. For example, if one of them would be violated, you won't be able to say which part of gravity is wrong.
Right.
It's just some combination of different parameters. Yeah. direct probe of pulse in the spheres and planetes and another GR test. It turns out that pulsar A is eclipsed once per period. So here is a rotational phase of B, here is an orbital phase of B. So if you average over orbit, you will get the average pulse profile. And we can see these two blank stripes. And this is at superior conjunction when A is behind B. I'm the observer, this is B, this is A, A is behind, it is absorbed. The eclipse is very interesting. So here is a light curve of A as it passes behind B. So the vertical dashed lines are the moments when we see emission from B. And as you can see, eclipse is modulated in the initially it is modulated, there are two absorption troughs and two transparent spikes per period of B. Then in the middle there is one transparent spike. Then in the end there is nearly complete absorption. Okay? So we have modulation at half a period, changing to modulation at a period of B, and then full eclipse after the conjunction. And absorption is magnetic axis is pointing towards us, so you can see that, so this one is very clear, it really aligns with the moment we see a pulse of B, so when B is looking at us. Also, the average profile is nearly frequency independent. That's important for determining what is doing the absorption. So, in the beginning I showed you the picture of isolated pulsars, which has dipolar field lines and light cylinder.
Yes. How are you separating the emission from B and the emission from A? Because, I mean, they're both,
but the frequent, one is at 22 milliseconds and another is at 2.7 seconds.
Yeah, but I mean, when I'm looking at this plot, shouldn't you just add addition of both of them?
Yes, but B is much weaker than A, radiatively. Emission from A is much, much brighter.
Okay, so B is in principle there, but I don't see...
B is in principle there, but... and again, even if you wanted to take it, it would be easy to take out because you know the B profile.
Okay.
So, the picture of isolated pulses that I described is not really applicable here because magnetosphere of B is modified by the wind of A. Similarly, the case like the sun produces wind that distorts Earth magnetosphere. Here, pulse A, which is it's reasonably powerful, much more powerful than pulse B, produces a wind that creates somewhat similar structure of the around B magnetosphere as the sun, wind, and Earth magnetosphere. And here is a model which shows that a wind of A coming from this direction. So this is the light cylinder, and there are some analytical calculations and simulations. And as you can see, the wind of A blows off like half of the B magnetosphere. So it's strongly distorted magnetosphere.
So how do you represent the wind from A? In this calculation?
In the simulations or in analytical?
In analytical,
these shapes come from... the wind of A is just a pressure.
Okay.
That comes from the balancing of magnetostatic pressure of the magnetosphere, of the static magnetic field, with the normal component of the pressure from the wind, the so-called Campanian approximation.
Yeah.
Okay, so we will do the model of the eclipse, and we will neglect these distortions. So we will assume that there are still open and closed field lines, and we assume that closed field lines are populated by relativistic plasma with some density, and there will be synchronous absorption on closed field lines. So in a more advanced model we do ray tracing, but that's not that important. So, and qualitatively, the synchrotron absorption can occur in a broad range of frequencies. So qualitatively, the moment line of sight crosses the absorption region, all the frequencies are absorbed. So that's why it's frequency dependent. Why it's frequency independent. So eclipse profile is dependent mostly by generical factors. There are a few parameters that we need to fit. orientation of omega, the impact parameter, how we slice the linear sphere, then the angle between omega and mu, and some plasma density, and so plasma density and radius. So here is the model of the dipolar magnetosphere filled up with plasma. And it's all rotating, and well, doing a radiative transverse rotating magnetosphere. So as you can see, this model is much simpler than it should be. And I was a bit surprised when I was able to get this fit. So yellow is the data, red is the model. I can reproduce double modulation in the beginning. I can reproduce single modulation in the middle, nearly complete absorption at the edge. In the middle, the fit is exceptionally good. I can reproduce relative intensity of each transparent window. At the edges, the agreement is not very good, but that's okay, because we just discussed that at the edge of the hemisphere is strongly distorted by the wind, while close in it will be still dipolar. And here is a movie in real time that explains this fit. So red is the direction to the pulsar A, and it's moving the orbital motion. So, absorbed, transparent. So in the beginning, there are two absorption, two transparent windows per period. Now, as we move in, one of the transparent windows becomes smaller and smaller. So, absorbed, transparent. So we switch from double to single modulation. And then we go into nearly complete absorption. Absorbed at all phases. Again, that's in real time. The rotation is in real time and the motion of the pulsar. And then there is a very sudden egress. Also matches the rhythm of the popcorn. Yes, so the feed gives us extremely good parameters, geometrical parameters of the system. And initially mine was to within, say, half a degree, and then Grenet-Bretton redid it with much more complicated Monte Carlo Bayesian analysis and got it down to hundreds of a percent. So we know the angle between orbital plane and rotation axis is about 50 degrees. The angle between plane of the sky and omega is changing due to the genetic recession. That's what we'll discuss next. There is a very well determined angle between magnetic moments and rotation axis, so about 71 degrees. And also, there is a high density of plasma on closed field lines, about 10 to 5 times higher than expected. It's a bit worrisome, but not that worrisome, as again I will discuss next. So, genetic precession. So, there are two types of precession that will contribute. The first is a Thomas kinematic precession, meaning it's a V over C squared time effect. Basically, two Lorentz transformations are equivalent to Lorentz transformation and the rotation. So, as you transport a vector with some velocity, the vector would be the rotation direction, rotational spin of B, there is a V over C squared precession. In addition, there is a pure general relativistic effect, meaning if you transport a vector infinitely slow, but since the space is curved, where your circumference is smaller than 2pi, so when you come back, there is kind of this wedge missing, and that also adds to the precession of B. Okay? So, the shape of the profile, of the ellipse profile, depends on geometry. And here is, as B precesses, the shape of the ellipse changes. And general relativity tells us that the precession should be of the order of 75 years, And here is a prediction of how the shape of the eclipse should change on time scale of something like 20 or 30 years. From being right skewed, it will become very symmetric, and then left skewed 15 years later. No, but this is over a period of, as I say, 15, 20 years. And what could be done is, over the few years, very detailed fits to the of the parameters to the eclipse profiles at different epochs. And Baya, you cannot do it anymore, but René did it the same with very advanced codes. And here is three angles. So the angle between omega of B and plane of the sky doesn't change. Angle between omega of B and magnetic moment doesn't change. But what changes is angle of B with respect to the plane of the sky, or with the plane of line of sight. And that's due to the geodetic precession, the spin orbital coupling in general relativity. So, you can cast it in a more general theories of gravity. The precession rate would be semi major axes over the Shapiro delay, over that's the period, eccentricity, and this. You can call it the strong gravity constant, which is generalized Newton constant and some spin orbital coupling constant. And then we can compare what is observed. And here is our determination of the observed precession rate. And we can compare and we can then infer what this strong gravity coupling, what this strong gravity constant is. That's what we measure, and general relativity predicts for the, we know the masses and all the Keplerian parameters. General relativity predicts this value, and they agree with each other to within 10%, which is pretty good. And it's the same precision as gravity probe beam. 10% same accuracy, but of course at a fraction of a cost. And here is our new the range of our new allowed parameters, this omega b, and as you can see, it's not still as good as the other limits, but you know, it's almost perpendicular, and it is expected to be much better with the hope was it would be much better with time, because the errors would narrow down as kind of square of time. Unfortunately, I will discuss next. So we are measuring theory of gravity in a strong regime at the source, and that's different from what the lunar radar, lunar ranging, and gravity probe B, which measures gravity in a weak regime. Here at the source, we're about 20% strong. So, at the source, gravity is strong, and dependence of parameters measured far out at the it depends on the source, and it can be different in different theories of gravity. So, it is a test in a strong field regime. So, in this case, we measure 6 plus Keplerian parameters, price ratio of masses, minus 2 masses that we don't know. So, we have 5 independent GR tests. And it's only in the double pulse we can measure the mass ratio, that's the R, that's what Cliff asked before, the ratio of masses. And here is a list of these post-Keplerian parameters. As you can see, we're advanced to periastron, we're getting into the 10 to the minus 5 precision. Shapiro delay, RNS, gravitational redshift, that was the gravitational redshift, the decay of the orbit. And then this our spin precession, which is not as good, but it's a new and independent test. And also no preferred frame effects in strong view regime again. This would have shown up in timing. Unfortunately, we are losing B because of the genetic recession. The beam of B is missing now. So here is a profile of B as time goes up. It becomes noisy and noisy, and now we lost it. And here is this kind of model, the minimum angle between line of sight and the magnetic moment. And now it's become large enough, so we missed it. We are missing it. Probably it will come back around 2020 or 30.
Maxim, so you guys, from your model, could you predict also the rate at which it's going to be disappearing and then compare with those, with the rate that you've seen?
Let's wait. I will address that. Well, not exactly that question, but related questions. The conclusion. Giardia's strong regime is satisfied in some post-Keplerian parameters to the 10 to the minus 4 precision. So any competing theory of gravity would need to then would reproduce only not only Newtonian, but first post-Newtonian correction. And of course, there is always the question which scales and relevant scales is A used. And solar system tests, in some parameters, they are down to better precision, but I stress that it's in a weak regime. Here it's in a strong regime.
I still don't understand this argument. Why you say it's in a strong regime? It's true that the gravity at the source is strong, but you're not testing it at the source, you're testing it at the position of the other pulsar.
Yes, yes. We're measuring many parameters. We're measuring 6 parameters there.
Yeah.
It's parameters at the source in different theories of gravity would predict different asymptotic expansions for these 6 parameters. Mm-hmm. And the fact that these all 6 are consistent, they give single. They do reduce to 2 single masses.
In
different theories, you can imagine that these single masses would be different. But still, the fact is that they do reduce to 2 single masses does eliminate, as I understand, some theories of gravity. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, none of the competing theories of gravity were. None of them calculated the spin precession rate. So we haven't excluded anything, but it's because they didn't bother to calculate it.
So this spin precession rate is just that you have like a gyroscope that's precessing in the gravity of this other pulsar.
It's a gyroscope that is precessing along the total angular momentum of the system, which is composed of the orbital angular momentum plus the spins, but the spins are small, so it's a precession of one angular momentum virtually with respect to the orbital angular momentum. So it's a spin orbital coupling. Mm. Okay. Yeah, let me ask take more questions on testing GR. Because we are off a little bit.
Following up on Nash's question, it's not strong in the sense that GM over the impact parameter is 1 or anything. It's bigger than we're used to in the solar system.
Yeah, it's strong at the source. Yeah. The source is in a strong regime. Let's say, in different theories, you could imagine if the theory, so I don't know, if you have self-gravity, for example, different post-Keplerian parameters would be affected differently. And that difference would depend on the strong parameter at the source. I guess, but maybe not the right analogy, would be, I don't know, the dipolar moment of a neutron. We're measuring it far out, but it depends on, strong, presumably, it depends on the details of the interaction.
Right, because you could imagine a different gravity theory that when GM over R is close to 1, it's very, very different from GR, mm-hmm. but then quickly decays out, like a mon D in the shorter scale, to what GR would have. And so then that's Niai's point. you will still get your answer correct, but you will be testing the GMORR close to 1 because.
Yeah. I don't know, I can only repeat myself here. Again, it's phenomenological, so it's all parameterizing.
Sure, no, that's...
And the trick would, it would be more like against general relativity. The trick would be if the we would measure inconsistent Poincaré parameters, then that would kill general relativity. We wouldn't know what part of general relativity is wrong.
The issue for you would be if supposing I wanted to set up the equation of state for the neutron star, then you're saying that that's a strongly coupled program where I have to, if there was a prediction I could make from that I could test, then I would be seeing strong gravity there.
Yes.
As opposed to these orbital parameters, which are really seeing the properties of the geometry around in the orbits that are quite far. But you're not testing anything which is like a mass.
No, I think what I'm talking more about this effacement idea that it doesn't matter what the equation of state of a neutron star. All matters is the mass, and that what goes into all the Poincaré parameters. If you would have, say, terms that would go as mass squared at the source, they could have shown up at the Poincaré parameters in this strong regime, but they would not show up in solar system tests.
But I think what we're worried about is that in practice, if I have like a scalar tensor theory, then it is true that it changes, again, you know, the structure of the star changes in the sense that the prediction you get for, you know, the mass versus the radius point is now going to be different. But if you just wanted to count the parameters that you would have outside the star, coming from the fact that there was some boundary condition you're satisfying inside the star, it wouldn't really qualitatively change. If I didn't know what the structure of the star was, I would just phenomenologically assign.
That's right. That's what I was saying. That in and this is getting a bit beyond my knowledge of other alternate theories of gravity. In other theories of gravity, this could be still consistent, only if those other theories of gravity reduce to single two masses, and that's it. This could be different masses, but it must reduce to two masses, different masses than NGR. And as I understand, in some theories it's not true. The Poincaré parameters do not reduce to just two single masses.
In principle, one thing that happens for these pulsars is that it also depends on the value of the scalar field or something.
That's right. That's right.
But the thing is, do you ever actually test that? In the sense that do you have a handle on, if you compare all the pulsars that have been looked at, is there a handle on an observational handle on whether or not something like that has changed from pulsar to pulsar, even though they're in a different environment?
I don't think you can even do this. This particular source is the best one, both in the numbers of Poincaré parameters measured,
and
the precision. It is way beyond anything done in other cases.
So unless you can compare them, then you don't really have that a handle on that, and so then it just becomes weak field test.
It's a phenomenological test.
Yeah. No, I think maybe I can elaborate this point that, like in the chameleon, in Justin Kurek's chameleon theory, the idea is that the density region is decoupled from gravity. But so you have this extra scalar field which couples to low density matter but decouples from high density matter. So if you have gravity, so basically at large distances from the compact objects, you have the scalar field and you have metric. But if your compact object is very dense, then the scalar field is not sourced. But if your compact object is not very dense, like Earth, then the scalar field is sourced. So that would be in a way a test of a strong gravity. So then if you don't see the scalar field at large distances, you know that the object is very dense or something. So this would be a test of So the neutron star and Earth would have different predictions, basically, for this. You see what I'm saying?
Let me go quickly. The system is really, really amazing. So in those movies of turbulence during formation of a neutron star, this turbulence is supposed to give us a kick. And we can measure kick and a tumble in this system. So before the second supernova, the spins were aligned. And we know the geometry of the system very very well now. We know that the kick was very much in the plane of the orbit. So A remains nearly aligned. And we know the direction of B, it's actually counter-rotating. So we know that the second supernova gave us not only kick but also tumble. And a large fraction of B spin can be due to this tumbling during supernova explosion. There's more. There is a lot of interesting, exciting plasma physics that can be done. First, we still don't know what a pulsar radio emission, how it is produced. And all we know that it's a kind of a laser. Laser meaning you add waves coherently, then your intensity goes quadratically with the number of waves. And we don't still know where inside the pulsar magnetosphere radio emission is generated, whether close to the star or further out in the magnetosphere. It turns out that pulsar B is bright only at two orbital phases, and it's very dim everywhere else. And that can be interpreted as different distortions of this magnetosphere by the wind of A. And then by probing these distortions, orbital dependent distortions, we can try to resolve then a reverse problem. Where the emission, if we can model the distortion, we can ask a question. Where the emission should be generated to give us these two bright regions? And here we're using a lot of space physics methods, for example, the model of confined Earth magnetosphere by the solar wind adopted to our pulsar, and we have three-dimensional, we trace magnetic field lines everywhere. And here is our preliminary results. So here is our orbital phase and rotational phase of B in this particular region. And this is the model, and that's the view of the real data. And as you can see, it looks pretty good. You know, you have two bright regions. It's not exactly, the fit is not exact, but, we're getting there. Also, since due to the geodetic precession, the line of sight changes, we're having a different look at the pulsar magnetosphere as a function of time. And as you can see, here is two phases, two bright phases, pulsar B, and how it evolves with time. You see, initially it was one bright peak, now it's split into two bright, into two peaks. So then we can try to model what should be the emitting region to reproduce this splitting between single and double. And so here is our emission. This is now, it's not a cartoon, it's a physical determination of where emission region in the magnetosphere is located. And we can reproduce splitting from one into double pulse. So here again, it's a more three-dimensional picture. And this, again, this is not cartoon, this is real calculations of where the emission in the magnetosphere of B is generated. So, and then we determine the radii of emission.
And so what is the source of the emission?
It's a pulsar, it is working as a laser. Pulse itself. And we still don't know where inside the magnetosphere that laser is operating. And I was trying to describe how by modeling the distortions of B, we can pinpoint where it is located.
And where is it physically? So where do the lines turn around? I mean, it seemed to There seemed to be some information in the picture that I probably didn't get. But.
So, okay. So this is the bounding, the Bauschot, the blue is the shape of the magnetosphere,
okay,
which is bounded by the wind of A coming from that direction. And then this is all moving orbitally and rotating. And we know exactly everything in everywhere. And then by placing emission at this particular region, we can reproduce both the orbital modulation, meaning two bright sectors,
okay,
and switching from single to double.
So the game you play is you pick a particular region,
right,
of your magnetosphere, assume that there is emission there, make what, a synchrotron or...?
Doesn't matter, only the field lines.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And we're trying to solve the inverse problem.
Yeah.
There is more. In the Earth magnetosphere, reconnection is an important process. Reconnection is a process by which magnetic field lines directed in different, they're oppositely to each other, reconnect. So, and this is responsible, and this usually happens close to the cusps, well, in the cusps and in the tail. And that is responsible for aurora borealis, this reconnection effect. That's where the aurora borealis comes in. It turns out that B is not just rotating, it is also jittering. If you look at me, it's also jittering as it rotates. And that jitter frequency is related to the frequency of A. So the idea is that A produces a wind, relativistic wind, that is beating on the magnetosphere of B and produces this jittering. Meaning we can use this pulse of B as a probe of the magnetosphere of the wind of A only 1,000 light cylinder radii away. It's extremely short distances. One important thing that can be already inferred. Since this beating is with the frequency of A and not with the double frequency, as would have been if it just a pressure wave, it's a single frequency. That means direction of magnetic field is important in the wind of A. So that again only tells you that the wind is kind of a wave with alternating magnetic fields. There, how then we can model this jitter? And here again we use the Earth magnetospheric models in the limit of strong resistivity. Meaning, if we take a dipole and add magnetic fields that are switching in the wind. The difference from the Earth magnetosphere is that in case of a solar wind, the magnetic field also switches directions, but on a scale much longer than the size of the Earth's magnetosphere. Here, the switch occurs about 5 times per magnetospheric size. So then we expect that at some half periods, magnetospheric field lines will be able to propagate into the wind, and as they're dragged, this will distort the magnetosphere, and that will give this jitter. And other period, half a period, is kind of suppressed. So the magnetosphere would look like this punk haircut, that every half a period the magnetic fields will be sticking out, and other half a period they are pushed down. I really like this photo because I think we can even reproduce these curls. So, again, we're doing a three-dimensional model. This is called a Dungey type of magnetosphere. And that will also give us determination where emission is generated, because this jitter depends on how high up we put up our emission. One more thing. Let me skip the details. Here is the origin of... let me not skip the details. So for the eclipse, we need high density on closed headlines. And here, it turns out that there's this effect called magnetic bottling, again, which is important for Earth magnetosphere, that particles are reflected from regions of high magnetic field. And in case of the double pulse, only one in a million falls onto the surface. meaning to create large overdensity, we need to supply it at a kind of small rate, not too strongly. And here again, we use methods developed for Earth and Jupiter magnetospheres. These Wallanen radiation belts, particles diffuse from the solar wind into the closed field lines and are trapped there. And we're using similar models, but in a coordinating sphere, to calculate this diffusion of particles and the formation of these Van Allen radiation belts in the pulsar magnetosphere. Also, rotation of pulsar B, it turns out that pulsar B is very noisy. And in the last part of my talk, I described all the various distortions of the magnetosphere that we can model. And the noisiness of B is now the main error in this in the test of GR. And so our hope is that understanding the dynamics of the magnetosphere will lead to improvements of the timing of B and GR tests. Okay, thank you.
So the fact that you're not seeing B anymore, does that mean that you don't have, so from the point of view of testing GR, it's like a single pulsar system, and any gain you get will be just from the one pulsar until when you...
That's right. Yes. Plus, we are losing our ability to model the eclipse well. So we're not only losing the second clock, we're also decreasing the ability to model, because you know it's related to the pulsar of B, the periods. So we are kind of it's bad for that too.
But there's noise limitations, isn't it? Better or something? It's gonna be, that's something which we're stuck with until we come back.
Yes. Well, or unless you know, if we come up with good model of noisiness of B due to all these distortions. There is like 5 or 6 years of data that we can go back and review.
The pulsar A overwhelms the dynamics because it's the most rapidly rotating, and therefore the outflux from it is the strongest.
Yes, that's right. That was the point of my... So it's the A that distorts B strongly. Okay, so... Yeah, so that's more of the picture. A is completely unaffected by B, but B is strongly affected by A because...
But it's not necessarily because it has a much stronger magnetic field, it's just because it's rotating a lot faster.
Yes. The power goes as omega to the fourth and magnetic field squared. So omega is 100 times faster for the... And the field is only maybe... couple of orders of magnitude smaller. Maybe even less.
So you had a slide where you talked about the precession frequency of the spin about the angular momentum.
Yes.
And how it was measured and then also predicted in general relativity. So it would be interesting to predict this in other theories of gravity. And
that's
just,
right.
And I'm just wondering, do you know if work either has been done or is in progress?
Damour, I think, promised to do something, but that was a couple of years ago, and I don't know if he did. No, I don't know.
Just a comment on that. I think there, if there isn't one or two calculations that come out very recently, they will be very soon, because now the LIGO will probably be testing these kind of things. People are going back to these the few remaining prospective theories and trying to get definite answers for testing things with gravity.
But in the review that Damour wrote a few months ago, he didn't mention anything. He didn't mention if this excludes any theory. But nobody calculated it before we measured it. Yeah.
So this is just the precession rate of the spin of a single pulsar, or is that?
Yes.
Is that there?
So if they calculated it, it could in principle further constrain the parameters of their scalar tensor theories that are allowed.
Yes.
But I don't think it could outright exclude them just because they always have this flexibility to just further constrain constant parameters.
That I don't know.
But there are much stronger constraints on the scalar constraint theories than the other PPN constraints. So, I mean, the question is, this is not as, this is only 10%, so there must be something as not probed by other tests and just by this.
But also, this is again, it's in a strong regime, and all other tests are in a weak regime.
Any other questions? Okay, if not, then Maxime will be here for the rest of the day. And